Welcome to the My Why podcast, where educational storytellers Jesse Mann and Kristen Travers discuss identity-defining moments with special guests. Inspiration ensues.
Jesse and I are thrilled to talk to our next guest. This topic might be a little hard to discuss and triggering for some. I know it is for me, but I think it's a needed conversation worth getting a little bit uncomfortable. Maren Sutherland is only 22 years old, but seems to have lived enough for several lifetimes. She is a physical and sexual assault survivor, but she is so much more than that. She is an English major, a writer, a blogger, and a self-described farm kid, and someone who is figuring it out as she goes. Welcome, Maren. We're so happy to have you.
Thanks for coming, Maren.
Thanks, Maren. Hey,
thank you so much for having me.
We wish the listener could see when she walked up. She's got this trendy, wonderful, adorable outfit, and yes. It just makes me want to be 22 again.
I know. I still think I'm 22.
Yeah, it's funny. I will watch reality TV, and there'll be somebody in there acting, you know, silly and immature, and they're just having fun, and it'll be, you know, Ashley, 21. I'm like, man, she's acting. Why is she acting like that? Like, I'm the same age as her. I would never do that. Yeah, never mind. You're 12 years older than that lady. And you
21.
You were twice as bad at 21.
Yeah. I think 22 is the best age ever.
You know what? Actually, it is a great age.
Yeah. Why do you think that?
Well, I think it's the best so far for me.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, I don't know.
I thought 22 was pretty good.
We'll see. I'll probably be saying the same thing about 23 and 24 and probably 35. And I'll probably say every year is better than that.
You seem to have like such a zest for life.
I totally do.
Yeah, you do.
I totally do.
Yeah. So we are going to dive right in, Maren. We are so honored you're here. Tell us a little bit about Maren growing up.
So, Maren growing up, I grew up on a farm, on a cattle ranch. We had a cow-calf operation. My dad and my grandpa ran that. And so they're actually still running it. So a huge part of my background was agriculture and, you know, harvest and calving. And so I grew up outside. I didn't spend a lot of time inside. I was always out in the mud and in the dirt with the boys. I have three brothers. So, from a pretty young age, I was pretty tough. So, you know, we rode horses, and then it just kind of, you know, things evolved and started getting on some colts. And so now I ride a lot of colts, and, you know, we just kind of, we do our own thing. And we have a pretty small operation compared to a lot of these bigger guys, but it's big enough for us. And so we do that.
Were you the youngest sibling?
I'm the middle.
You're the middle.
Yeah, I'm the middle, and I'm the only girl. So,
yeah.
So I have two older brothers and one younger. So
I can relate to that. It's kind of special, isn't it?
It is kind of special. You know, I didn't really get, technically I didn't get any sisters, but I'm very close with two of my cousins who are a year younger than me, and they're twins. And so I kind of did grow up with sisters almost, but I don't think it was really the same. You know, brothers, it's different. It's a little bit harder.
Yeah, it is different. Yeah, tough. For sure.
Yeah. Tougher. Yeah. Not harder, but
well,
just,
and farm,
you know,
kids in general, we're all three of us are farm kids.
Yeah.
We're a different breed. I mean,
well, I think we're the best breed.
Totally.
What are some of those lessons you learned on the farm that you have tried to really put at the core of who you are?
You know, I think respect is a huge one. When we were kids, we were expected, you know, you go to the bull sale, you go to the auction mart, and you can play under the bleachers and you can have fun with your friends, but you have to be able to, you know, understand what the adults are talking about, and you have to be able to, you know, if people call on you, you should be knowing, you know, what you want to say, and you should be contributing to the conversation, and that's your responsibility, and you need to be respectful. And that was a huge one. Obviously, you know, anything with animals, you kind of know from a young age, it's you take care of things, and you do your best to do that, whether it be, you know, getting up every day before school, going out and feeding your horses or your calves in the cold, or moving trailers around to take the truck to school, or anything like that. You know, there's priorities. You know, you learn to prioritize really well. You know, you can't hang out with your friends if you're calving. You know, right. You gotta kind of go out and you gotta get your sleep so you can get up in the night and go out and look. And so there's so much that I think farm kids are exposed to. And, you know, I think that we're given such a good advantage in life. And I try and be mindful of that privilege, you know, when I go into different opportunities and different kind of scenes. You know, I had a 4-H calf. I guess we had to do a larger calf or a large animal project for 4-H. And at the end, when you sold your animal, that went into an education fund. And so, you know, we're just so privileged, you know, farm kids, but we work hard. And, you know, I try and be mindful of that. And,
right.
But, you know, you learn so much. And I think it really, really projects us forward in life at a very young age. And
we learn to be a hard worker.
Absolutely.
And it kind of shows, like, you are a writer now.
Yes, I'm trying, yeah, I guess.
Have you always loved writing when you were younger?
No, I always loved it. I didn't really try very hard in school. I mean, I got 80s in school, but I didn't really. I knew I could do it. English was my best subject, but I didn't really, you know, I didn't really care. I was very, in high school, immature, and, you know, but
as we all are, most yeah. of us, I definitely was.
Totally. And I pushed that part of me away for so long. You know, it was kind of, it didn't really, you know, high school and being a teenager, it's hard to fit in. And, you know, you kind of want to do what everyone else is doing. That's when social media really, really blew up. And so kids were always on their phones and, you know, you weren't really grabbing a notebook and writing in your journal for 2 hours. You're scrolling through.
Yeah, I guess that's a different experience than Jesse and I had. Like, when we graduated, social media kind of blew up. You were in the midst of
high exactly. school when that kind of happened. Honestly, that's when, you know, Instagram got really big. And, you know, you were kind of, I don't know, it was different, but.
And we definitely didn't have a phone in high school.
No, I didn't have a phone. Not at all. And school. I mean, my job now really centers around social media and communication and that kind of thing. But I always say I'm so glad and I'm so lucky because I probably wouldn't have the job I have today if social media would have existed then.
Honestly,
and we laugh, but I'm it's pretty so serious. True.
Yeah, it's I would have so made true. Different choices, I think, and I would have put some things out there, I think, that I maybe would have regretted or something, right?
So. Yeah, it's a crazy concept, you know, the whole idea of social media. And
it really is. I mean, it gives everybody a platform, which is so cool. There's so many benefits to social media.
So many.
But. Yeah, there is always that but.
So writing right now, like back to writing, it's giving you an outlet.
It honestly, it really is. I just kind of, I couldn't, when I, first after my assault, my brain was very, very foggy and I couldn't form ideas. I couldn't hold on to ideas. And so I couldn't do it for so long. And I think that's when I really realized, you know, well, I need to get it out, but I couldn't. And so I think that's when it kind of, when I didn't have it, was when I realized, you know, if you're thinking about it when you don't have it, I think that's a pretty good indicator that maybe you should maybe at least explore it a little bit, you know, foster that curiosity and see where it takes you, I guess.
So for the listeners that are listening at home, Maren is a physical and sexual assault survivor.
I am.
Like I mentioned in the intro. And do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely.
As much as you feel comfortable.
Absolutely. So it was July 14th, 2018. I woke up. It was a Saturday. And we had plans that night pretty later on in the day that we were going to go out for kind of to celebrate. I had just turned 21. So my birthday is July 9th and this was on July 14th. And so I was kind of going out to meet with some friends and I wasn't planning on drinking. I remember telling my younger brother at the time, I think he was 16. Yeah, 16. I just said, don't wait up. I'll be back. And so, I went to town and it was kind of a foggy day. So it got darker earlier. So it was dark at around 10 when it usually wasn't at that time in the year. And so I drove in and I'm kind of just northeast of town. So I kind of take like the back roads going in just to skip all the lights and stuff. We were going to the brew house and so it's on the other end of town. And so I pulled over because I was actually planning on driving, and a car came up and they were going pretty fast, and then they just kind of like stopped. And the door swung open and I didn't really know what was happening. And then there was kind of like 1, 2, 3, 4 big steps. And I was like, oh no. And there was three guys in the car. Only one got out that I know of. But he cracked my head against my passenger window. And I initially, that's kind of all that I felt was just this crack. And it just... it hurt. And then, you know, I didn't really fight. I didn't really know what was happening. I was kind of just like, okay, well, I know this is happening, but I didn't, you know, flight or fight. I was kind of freeze. And I really didn't know what was happening. And then, you know, I didn't get this memory back until a few months after, but he grabbed this little like pocket knife and stuck it in me a few times, 6 times. And then we went down and he got on top of me, kind of grabbed me by my throat. And it was kind of, I couldn't breathe and I was kind of fighting and, you know, I almost kind of threw up. And and then he assaulted me, first with his fingers and then, himself, after that. So I don't really know how long the whole assault took place. I'm very kind of like, and that's still, I kind of question sometimes. I'm like, well, it seemed like it was like hours and hours, but I'm sure it could have only been, you know, maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes, maybe. I'm the whole concept of like time and like a moment like that is just, it's so questionable. And I'm kind of like, I still, yeah, to this day, I'm like, I wonder. But then after he was finished, he got back in his vehicle and they drove away. And I was kind of like, oh, I didn't really know what just happened. And so I was obviously bleeding. And so I pulled my seatbelt and I locked it. And then I pulled myself up. And I remember like distinctly thinking, oh, maybe I should call an ambulance. Like, but then I also remember saying, you know, no, it's a Saturday nightmare. And they're going to be busy. You can drive. It's fine. Come on. Let's just get over there. Okay. Let's just do it ourselves. Then I don't have to rely on anyone. And I'm just, that's what I remember thinking. And so I got in, I found my shoes. I don't know what that was about. My shoes were somehow taken off during the assault. And before I wanted to go to the hospital, I wanted to get my shoes. I think that was adrenaline and, you know, shock. I just had, I'm going to get my shoes. And so, yeah, I pulled myself up. I got into my little Rogue and I drove backwards. I backtracked to the hospital and I drove. And I actually drove past a cop who had pulled someone over, but I didn't stop and tell him what happened. I just knew that I needed to go to the hospital. Right. And so I just kind of kept going and I pulled my vehicle around and I got out and I went in there and I remember the wait time was astronomically long, like 8 hours or something. And I was like, oh my goodness, I don't think I can wait that long. And then the nurses came and then there was kind of a frenzy. And then I remember I was kind of in my room, the trauma room. And I was like, and then it kind of hit me and I was like, okay, this is a little bit more, I think I need to be taking this a bit more seriously at this point. You know, I didn't stop at where you register to go into emergency. I didn't get that far. I just, and yeah, they just took me right into the trauma room and I was like, oh, well, they didn't take my blood pressure. I think this is a little bit more on the serious side.
Right.
And so that's when it kind of, and then, you know, it's adrenaline at that point, and it's just, okay, we're here. It's okay. And then they're like, and I remember saying, they asked me if I was actually in a car accident, and I said, no, I was raped. And that's what I said. I didn't say that I was stabbed. I said that I was raped. And, yeah, then they just, all the girls, the nurses came in and they got right to work, you know, Kristen, damage control. And then they asked me if I wanted to call the cops. And then you could tell they were kind of like, oh, well, I don't really know, kind of. I don't think a lot of people obviously report sexual assault. And so it's kind of, you know, when someone does come in, it's like, oh, maybe we should. Whereas, you know, yes, you have to call the cops. But, you know, I remember it was kind of a younger nurse, like a student, I think. And, well, do you want me to call the cops? And another, we're caught, they're on the way. And so, so yeah, I think that was kind of the gist of that part. And then, I was in the hospital. I did my rape kit, with two nurses. The cops came. I did statements actually before the rape kit because there was no female police officers out that night. So they actually called in Alana. I'm so grateful that she came in that night to photograph me and do my rape kit. But she was off duty and she came in to do that. So before that, then we did statements. I was with Constable Kevin Crosley. He was amazing. And yeah, I did that. We did lots of statements, just kind of statement. What did he smell like? What did he, you know? And we just, he was patient and I did the best I could. And then at that point, sexual services was in. And so Maria from sexual services, she was in there with me. And then we also had a rep from victim services who she came. She knew that I was taking care of those, so she decided to head out. I think I had about six police officers in my room and a few more outside. And yeah, nurses, we were good. She didn't. So, but Kelly from victim services made a stop in as well. And then, yeah, the statements, like I said, rape kit was done. Yeah, I was pretty beat up. I was bleeding kind of all over my face and my mascara was smudged and I was like, oh, and I remember opening my phone and I went on like Snapchat and I was like, oh man, I look like shit. Oh my God. You know? but they took such good care of me. I could never repay them. It was so inspiring to see just a team like that just come right in and just, Jill Jack was also a nurse there. She was the lead nurse. Phenomenal. She was amazing.
Well, so, and I think it, like, we need to give some credit to you to pull yourself out of the ditch and go to the hospital.
I mean, I think that was the farm kid in me. I wasn't really gonna rely on anyone else to get me there. I was just, let's just next step. So,
just next step.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, just kind of, I think that's all you can really do is we'll process it later. Just, you know, get to safety. And it's kind of, I still kind of wonder, you know, if I didn't get stabbed and if I wasn't bleeding, and I wasn't really, really messed up, I wonder if I would have went to the hospital. I wonder if I would have reported. Help? Would I have gotten help? And would I have silently, like, struggled with this and ultimately ended up doing who knows what? It's a scary thought.
Well, and you know, we talked about this before the podcast about, like, mm-hmm. 1 in 3 women are, you know, reported sexual assault. But really, I think that number is
much higher.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, people silently, you know, go through that, you know, because they have bills to pay and they have children to feed. And, you know,
well, and there's a lot of shame attached to sexual assault.
There's a lot of, and it's just guilt and it's heavy stuff. It's really, really heavy. And so, you know, I often think of women who are dealing with it silently. And it's a huge part of why I've decided to kind of put this big, you know, uncomfortable spotlight on myself, you know,
because you're an advocate.
I am. And I think to be an advocate, I think, is to first stand for yourself. And then I think that's a huge part. And that's what I really learned from, that's what I've learned, you know, from it, is a huge part of that is standing for yourself and then, you know, giving from your overflow to whoever you, I don't know, kind of, if that makes sense.
That makes 100%
sense. You know, like, we have not been 100% forthcoming with, you know, our previous, you know, mm-hmm. sexual assault and that kind of stuff. And so when I was younger, I was, you know, mm-hmm. quite a bit younger, I was sexually assaulted and physically assaulted. And I didn't have the support system that you have now. Yeah. So I didn't feel comfortable talking about it. And I didn't feel comfortable sharing a lot. So I feel very privileged to know your mom, mm-hmm. because your mom has been such a big advocate for you.
And yes.
your whole family has been such a big advocate
for
you.
They have fearlessly advocated for me. And it's been so powerful to see. And, you know, they never once questioned or, you know, doubted or judged. It was always, you know, just support and we are here. And I think that's really, really great to see, for people who aren't a part of my family. You know, it's very inspiring to watch, you know, someone's family, you know, always
rally around
people that, and, you know, we've had troubles, you know, before people, but we always stick together and, you know, rally around one another when they need it. And
right.
I think that's what family is for. And it's a huge part of, I think, my recovery, and my, even just the way that I like write. It's just, that's always in the back of my head, you know,
that you feel safe
that
and
I'm,
supported.
Yeah. That I'm, you know, lifted up by these people, and it makes a huge difference. Totally.
So building on that, your recovery process, you know, and I mean, you're here and you're able to talk about it, but mm-hmm. recovery will last a very long time, if
yes.
not forever. So
yes.
talk to us a little bit about that recovery process. So you're in the hospital. You obviously need to mm-hmm. heal up in more ways than one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I obviously had to heal a lot physically. And, you know, I had vaginal tearing. It wasn't anything crazy, but I was torn, and so that takes time to heal. And, you know, obviously there was a lot of blood, and, you know, my family had to see that, and, you know, lots of just it was very, very uncomfortable. I couldn't sit, I couldn't lay down, and I think I went crazy. I have bits and pieces of it, but it's not all, because I was so heavily medicated, and I was just, and I didn't really know what had happened, and I was just kind of like, and my poor mom, she was just trying to help, and I was like, I can't find any way to get comfortable,
right.
And she was just doing her best, and I'm just a nutcase, but I think I needed that, and, you know, I think I needed my mom to take care of me. For a while at least. But a huge part of my recovery was I isolated myself, and for about six or seven-ish months, I only saw my immediate family and my doctors, and I didn't see. And coming from, I'm very like, I'm just like a social butterfly. I was a waitress, and I always connected with people, and Every day I was immersed in the community and with my friends. And so going from that to nothing for, you know, 6-7 months, with obviously some pretty heavy trauma, I was alone, and I wouldn't let anyone, you know, my friends brought me gifts and they dropped off flowers, but, you know, I didn't want to see anyone. And I think that was the shame too, you know, and, you know, it's so hard, you know, especially with sexual assault, you want to be able to just scrub it off and, you know, just kind of, and I couldn't do that. I was in the hospital, and then I couldn't shower because I was obviously very injured, and it was just, I couldn't get clean, and it just, it was the worst feeling ever. And I think that that's a big part of why I, you know, isolated myself, and why I was, because I just felt dirty, and I just, it was not a good, and I just, I'm someone, I like to be confident, and, you know, when I'm around people and I want them to kind of feed off of me, and I just, there was no way that I could even let myself be around anyone. I was just embarrassed, and so I didn't see anyone, and that was very, very detrimental to me. I struggled so much, and a huge part of that as well was that I couldn't really get in to see a psychiatrist, and I was just off the walls, medicated all 24/7. I Ativan, lorazepam, you know, Valium. It was all just, and my poor family doctor, he's the best man. He just had no idea what to do, and right. We just couldn't get anywhere, and he was so frustrated, and I completely understand. It was so tough, and you could just tell that he was just frustrated and that he couldn't really get anywhere, and so I was just medicated, and it just got really bad, and then, so I struggled really, really a lot in the first half a year following right. my assault. Then, you know, I started to heal up, and obviously I still feel it sometimes. It's uncomfortable. It's not, you know, my stomach, it hurts sometimes, and so I'm always kind of reminded by it. But after that kind of period of kind of physical healing, you know, I got in to kind of see a psychiatrist I got a referral, and I ended up not the weather. It's the weather in Canada. I couldn't get to Edmonton. Right. And so I couldn't end up seeing her, and she wouldn't see me. And that was very triggering to me. I was kind of putting all my cards into that for the past, you know, 3 months. And I ended up accidentally overdosing because I just wanted to go to sleep, and I hadn't slept. And it was just so, I don't know how to describe, like, that period of my life. It was just so dark and, oh, like, hopeless, and I was just so discouraged, and I couldn't sleep, and when you don't sleep for, like, 6 months, it's, and so I accidentally overdosed, and I had to spend January in the hospital, so that was a big setback for me as well, that overdose, and just kind of, like, knowing that I, like, willingly, you know, I was just, I want to go to sleep. I'm just so tired. Right. And, you know, I just took way more medication than I should have. And I think my body was kind of, you know, building up a tolerance almost to that as well. And it wasn't that I was, you know, addicted. I never felt that. I'm very careful with how I take my medication. But I just wanted to go to sleep. And so that was a huge setback, that overdose. But I think that ultimately gave me a little bit of push, you know, a little bit of forward momentum. And, you know, I kind of just stepped off from that. And then, you know, all through that, my mom was in the works of getting, you know, my service dog. And so, but that was, you know, it takes a long time for that to happen, right? So I was kind of just still struggling. But then, you know, it started to get, I could start to kind of hold on to ideas, you know, I could read a little bit, whereas, you know, after those first 6 months, I couldn't, my brain, it stopped working at all. I was hallucinating. I couldn't form any ideas. I could read, like, words, but I didn't understand what they meant, and it was so frustrating.
Well, your brain was overloaded.
My brain was overloaded.
Probably a little bit of post-traumatic stress, I'm assuming.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I was suffering crazily from PTSD, and it was so tiring, and I just, yeah. And then, but, you know, after I got out of my overdose, you know, in January, I tried, I really pushed myself to be able to, you know, read and go out and be doing stuff on the farm and just trying to like work and have some purpose. And, you know, I started my blog and my first blog, and that was really, really great for me. And then I started to kind of be able to, and all I could really talk about was what happened to me. I couldn't really form any ideas about anything else. And so that's what I did. And those were the thoughts that I had, and I put them out because I thought that, you know, I could make it a little softer for someone, you know? And so that was ultimately kind of why I started my first blog. And then that just kind of, it gave me something to put my time into. And, you know, I tried to check in a lot with myself, and just, I started to get back into, you know, my body. I dissociated from my body, obviously, from after getting sexually assaulted. And I was just, I had such a, not a good relationship with it anymore. And so I started to kind of build on that. And there was just a lot of stuff that, you know, you have to restart after. And, you know, I just kind of tried to take one thing at a time and then, you know, go back and maybe, and every day I tried to kind of do something that my future self would have thanked me for, you know, at the time. I did the best I could. Still looking back, you know, I was angry, you know, with myself for a long time. Why did I let myself, you know, just be by myself? Why didn't I go out? Why didn't I? And, you know, I just started being more gentle. You know, it's, you did the best you could, Maren, with what you had at the time. Just let's try and do better now.
And so what brought you to that point? Because not a lot of women get to that point of giving themselves grace and having self-worth. What brought you to that point?
What definitely brought me to that point was feeling what I had been ignoring, my emotions. I was so numb, and I didn't feel really happy. I didn't feel joy. You know, I was just kind of, it was all just nothingness. I was numb, and I didn't let myself be sad. I thought, you know, I just felt guilty for being sad. You know, people have it worse than I do. And so one day I just kind of woke up and I was like, oh, well, I don't really know what I'm going to do today. Well, I'm going to try and be sad. Okay. And so I started to kind of write down, a huge part of this actually was my lead investigator, Glenn Gabrick at the Lloydminster RCMP. He was talking to, we had a tough day after, some statements, and he was like, you know, I know you like to write, and I think that you should just be, I know you can't write, but I think that you should maybe just write maybe about the clouds or something. And so that's what I did. And I started kind of doing that, and it propelled me forward. That was the first step for me. And so, you know, I woke up and I just tried to let myself feel what I was feeling that day. And that was the first day that, and I just felt sad. And so I just let myself feel sad, and I just kind of like wrote down little, you know, ideas. Okay, well, I'm feeling a little sad. I don't really know why. Maybe it's because I got sexually assaulted. Maybe it's because someone felt that they had a right to my body, right. You know, or maybe it's because I don't have the food that I have in my house. And I just explored that. Right. I think that was the turning point for me, was really fostering my emotions in a gentle way and just noticing them and just not holding any judgment towards them and just feeling what I felt. You know, I'd been through something, and I had to tell myself too, like, oh, I always had to remind myself, oh, you went through this horrible thing, whatever, whatever. But, you know, I think once you start looking at the emotions that are a result of that, then that's when change can start to happen, you know? And then, so I felt sad, and then maybe I felt angry the next day, and I'd look at that and, okay, well, maybe why do I feel angry? Well, maybe because someone sexually assaulted me, maybe because my little brother's pissing me off. Maybe it's because, right. You know, and I just wrote down maybe these ideas, and then they eventually just kind of grew into tangents. And, you know, it was, you know, sometimes I'd write about how I how my body felt, you know, when I was getting assaulted, or, you know, maybe a memory when I was a kid that made me feel sad. But then, you know, I woke up one day and I was kind of happy, and I was like, oh, this is, man, the world seems kind of expansive today and bright, and, you know, kind of like before. And I just kind of like did the same thing.
Just noticed
and
it.
Noticed it and said, hello, I'm happy you're here. Please stay a while. And then it just kind of, that's what I've been doing. And that's the only thing I can do. I can't do anything else. I mean, I tried everything else. This is all that I have left.
Right.
And I think that it ultimately gave me everything that I've been able to accomplish since then. You know, I couldn't have done it. I couldn't write if I didn't know where my head was at or where my heart was at. You know, I have to explore these feelings and these emotions, and it's so hard, especially when you're not used to that. It's such a big adjustment. But if you just, you know, keep trying.
And I think the moment you notice those emotions is the moment you notice you are bigger than your pain.
Absolutely. You know, and it was hard for me to realize, I had thought for a long time that, you know, my pain was where I get my creativity and where I get, you know, my good ideas. And it's just like, no, that's not it, Marin. Stop. Absolutely not.
So you can have a happy life and Absolutely. Still be creative and still Absolutely. Be phenomenal.
Absolutely. I mean, why not? I mean, yeah, it's kind of.
So you're really speaking out now and sharing your story and talked about the whole advocacy piece.
Mm.
And I mean, you walk into the door and you're this bright, sparkly, happy person who's, you know, who's owning this and not letting it own you. How important for people who maybe are going through something similar to recognize that not every day is going to be like that. And if you have a bad day, that's okay too. And that's not a step back. That's not a failure.
No, absolutely not. I think I'm an English literature girl, and F. Scott Fitzgerald said it best, leave it alone. You did the best you could. It's, you know, let it go. There's, you know, I can't wake up and, you know, be sad because I was sad yesterday. You know, I can't do that. And I don't have time. I'm just not emotionally intelligent enough to be able to fall back into those patterns, because I don't know how long it's going to take me to crawl back out of there. And so that could happen. It could, but I'm not going to try and think about that, because I'm too busy. You know, and make yourself busy, you know, pick up a book and try and read this book, or, you know, read a magazine, or I don't know, like listen to music.
And you talked about, too, you know, being busy doing things that bring you purpose and meaning, right? So we have fallen into the trap with different things Kristen and I have faced, where we just get busy doing anything and everything.
To distract ourselves.
To distract. And so there's such a, I think, a fine line between distracting yourself and then actually filling up your cup kind of a
Totally.
Thing.
And still feeling your feelings. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you need to feel
Absolutely.
Those feelings.
And a huge part of that for me was getting back to that kind of safe space in my body. Whether it be by moving my body or touching my body, that was a huge part for me, was getting back in tune with, okay, this is all that you have, take care of it, and let that be a hobby. You know, I tried yoga, I went to spin class, that really helped me. And that really, it gave me something to kind of not necessarily look kind of forward to, but you know, when you're looking ahead to, okay, well, what am I going to do tomorrow? Or what can I do right now that, you know, could maybe help my body, you know, whether it be stretching. You know, stretching really helped me when, you know, my scarring, if they're irritated, I'll stretch, and that really helps. And then I think when you are connected to that kind of part where it's almost like you and your, I don't really know how to explain it, but I guess the best the best way is just, you guys might have to just give me a minute. See, now I've lost it.
No, that's okay.
And that's okay. It's I think that you touched on this before. It's your body.
Yeah.
Just because somebody else felt as though they had some right to it. This is your body.
That's where I was basically trying to go. So yeah, you know, there's such an invasion that you feel, you know, being a sexual assault and kind of taking that power back through that vessel that sounds kind of like hippy dippy, but I mean, trying to take that power back and saying, no, this is my body. I'm going to take care of it. And I'm going to, you know, do, you know, whatever I can to make it feel good and love it. And that's going to be that's what gives you confidence. That's what gives you some razzle dazzle. That's where it was for me. That's where I found it. It could be different for other people. But a huge part of that for me was just, I think, the violence of what, you know, I was a violent case, and that's kind of a 1% case. I didn't feel like I had the right to my body after that happened, because it had been so violently and horribly, you know, taken advantage of. And taking that power back was huge for my confidence, and it was huge for the way that I even viewed what happened to me, you know? Like, it's
when realizing that nothing that happened to you was anything to do with you and not your fault.
Yeah.
Right? That's an evolution, I'm sure.
Totally. And I never would have, you know, I always appreciated my body before. I was in really good shape, you know. But never, never like this. Never like this, you know. Especially when you survive something like that. If you, like, you survived a sexual assault, you know, any sort of, that's amazing that your body, you know, took that, and, you know, that's incredible. And I think that trying to mend that relationship that I think women have a lot too, you know, with social media and it's hard. It's so hard, you know. You look at the magazines and it's so hard, and, you know, taking that power back was huge for me. That was a huge stepping point in my recovery.
Well, and we have to commend you for that. I think if I could give, you know, the world one thing, it would be for, and you're right, women, I think especially, but all people to love the house you're living in.
Exactly.
And to look after it and feel comfortable in your body, no matter what it looks like. And for you to get back there after having gone through this, like, unbelievable.
Yeah. It's just, and it's being gentle too, and just not holding judgment, and just finding, you know, if you enjoy, I love yoga. You know, if I go in there and I stretch and I get, and I feel my body working, the muscles, I can stretch up, and it's incredible. And I don't know that other people can appreciate it as, you know, I don't want to say that, but I mean, especially after getting, like, so violently assaulted, it's been,
I think when you feel so disassociated from your body, then it's such an empowering feeling to connect.
It really, really is. And I really try and tell people who reach out and email to just try and get back to, you know, you don't have to just rub your leg. I don't know. Just do something.
Start small.
Rub your foot. I don't know. Like, that sounds so weird.
No, but
like,
no, it does 100%.
But it just, and then it's just building blocks. You can just keep doing more or whatever. Go. You can hike. You can do, and you get to hang out with yourself.
Do.
Yeah. And you can push it.
Well, and we're very big proponents of, like, you only get one life, and you have to choose your life.
Absolutely.
And so I think you have chosen, like, you had some difficult, awful stuff happen to you, but you're moving forward and
totally
choosing your life.
Totally. I don't have the, and I think it's kind of immaturity. I know that I won't be able to, if I get back into a habit of not really kind of being here now, then I could go back, and so I just try my best to just kind of, let's just keep rolling with the punches, and, you know, do what you feel is best. And
So what are some other things, Maren? Like, you're obviously taking recovery as a very active job. You know, you're really working at it.
I take it very seriously.
Yeah. What else are you doing, and what else can you share that may help other people that you do for yourself and you do for your recovery that you think is important for people who maybe have gone through something similar, but also just people who maybe need to connect a little bit more with who they are?
I think a huge thing is just learning, education, in whatever you want. You can, there's so many things you can learn about, you know, in your free time. Maybe instead of scrolling Instagram, you can watch a TED Talk and get a cool idea. Or you can, you know, read like a different kind of, I reread Pride and Prejudice the other month. And that's always huge for me, because I think modern writing is so different than like Stone Cold Jane Austen. And it always takes me, I've read it so many times, but every time it's just kind of, I always am like, oh, okay, this is good. And so I always try and tell people to try and just learn. You can learn about different movements. You can learn about the Me Too movement if you're passionate about sexual assault. You know, we look at Harvey Weinstein, he just got 23 years. That's huge for women. And so, you know, you can educate yourself on things like that, and you can kind of look to those women too, who have spoken out so bravely. Those hundred plus women that have spoken out, and the six that remain anonymous. But you know, you can look at the nonprofit sector and kind of learn about that and how that works. I've audited up a level courses that I didn't think that I really had the, I didn't have the balls to do that, but I did. I didn't do that great, but I mean, I'm still
but
doing
you're
still
it. Learning.
I'm still learning. I audit like upper level classes all the time. And yeah, read like a history article or something. And it's, I think that this world is so dark and it's heavy, but I think that if you take the time to learn a little bit about it, then it makes it a lot more enjoyable. And I think that really helped me too. Another thing, I guess, is just kind of being out and connect. Don't lose your connection mm-hmm. with people, because people are good. Not everyone is bad. You know, people have stories and they're a lot similar to you than you probably think. So I always encourage people to also, you know, keep that connection for humans, you know, try and keep it alive.
How important is your tribe, your group, your squad, your friends, there's so many different
things,
but how important is that circle?
They're so, so important. My friends are, they've been with me for, oh my God, through everything, through, you know, parties in the pasture, bonfire, to, you know, cool events and girls trips and weekends and boyfriends and girlfriends, and it's so great. And I think if you have a great group of friends, it really makes life a lot more fun. And when I was in the hospital and recovering, you know, whether it was from my overdose or, you know, being assaulted, a huge thing that I held on to is my memories with my friends for those 6 months that I isolated myself. I don't think I would have got through it without, you know, looking back on lots of these hilarious videos I have in my phone, or, you know, old memories of a stupid party or a fun wine night or anything. It's inspiring, and they do more for me than they ever could realize.
Right.
It's so enjoyable to go through life with such great people that you really connect with and you love dearly. It's awesome.
So great people. What about all of your fur friends? We got to talk about Bruno, your riding horses. Obviously that's near dear. Kristen's church is running. Like, she loves to run and loves to be active. Mine's on a horse. So I mean, I can definitely relate.
I love it. It's such a cool connection, you know, to be able to ride, and you know, it's like a drug, honestly. It's great. And I got on some colts a few years ago and I never went back. I think it's like riding regular horses on drugs. It's so cool. It's so fun.
A little scary sometimes.
And honestly, you know, getting on Colts, that's what kind of got my brain going again. I still couldn't, like, you know, as I kind of touched on this before, but my brain was really, I couldn't problem solve. And my first problem solving thing that I was riding Colts, and you know, every day is different with a Colt, and you gotta just,
you have to be present.
Yeah. And you've gotta fix a problem, you know. Yeah. Things are gonna, they're just learning. Yeah. And so you've gotta kind of, and you've gotta roll with it and find a solution to this, to this problem. And that was, that was what kind of got the ball rolling for me. And so I have three Colts at home that I'm working. I also have Bruno, my little fur baby. He's a golden retriever. And he's
your service dog.
He's my service dog. Yeah. So he's amazing. He actually came from Israel. The Israeli military trained him. So his first language is Hebrew. And so he takes all his commands in Hebrew, and he's just this little goofball. He's only a year and a half, so he's still kind of a puppy, but he works really hard, and he's a great.
So tell us a little bit about the process of getting Bruno.
So, honestly, I wasn't huge in the whole process. I was very much, as I said, down and out. My mom did the whole process. She reached out to George Leonard, who is the head trainer at MSAR, Service Dogs. And so we had an interview, and then it was just kind of a waiting game. You know, you go and they train these dogs, and then you just kind of wait for one to, you know, it takes time. It took me over a year to get him. I know a few of the Humboldt Broncos, their service dogs came from the same place. And so I think they also waited for around a year. Mm-hmm. But they're starting to grow a lot, and have more dogs kind of on hand, for, you know, veterans who, may need them but the process is, the biggest part is just waiting and kind of
waiting when you,
yeah,
you,
when
need
you,
it,
when you kind of need it. Support, yeah. 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 You know, my mom couldn't stay up with me all night. It's just not possible. I struggle a lot at night, and his sleep schedule is around mine. He's good. He wakes me up if I need to be woken up. If I don't, then he positions himself where he needs to be. He closes my door at night, and lays in front of it so that I feel safe. And I don't know.
Sounds like the best friend to have.
He really is. He's great. He's a big dorky goofball, honestly.
Well, it's important too, and we talked about this before we were on air, but it's important, and you're so wise, and you're so grown up, and
beyond,
you're so, so beyond. You said, you know, with what happened to you, it doesn't just happen to you, it happens to those you love around you, and it happens to the nurses that are there when you walk through the door. It happens to, and I mean, for you to say that is
so insightful.
Yeah, so insightful.
It's just, I can't help but, you know, think of the people who do deal with what happened to me in different ways. You know, I called my cousin and my best friend Jordan right after it happened, and she's had to deal with that. You know, she didn't get assaulted, but she has to deal with the fact that I called her, and when I was in hysterics, and she didn't know what was happening, and that was horrible for her to go through. And you know, she experienced it differently than I did, but she did. She experienced that. And you know, same with my family. They saw how, you know, they saw the blood, they saw the screaming, and it affects everyone, you know. And I did talk about this before, but you know, this happened in school. Jesse, you're a teacher. I may have went and, you know, opened up to a teacher and talked to a teacher, someone who is a safe person to go to. And that's a lot for people to hold on to. And that's a lot to work through too. And the nurses, you know, Kristen, you're a nurse, you know, I wouldn't want to see me that night, and they had to, and that's going to affect them for probably, you know, the rest of their careers. And it doesn't just affect me, and, you know, it affects the police officers. and the people who do this, who are experts in crisis. And yeah, my doctors, you know, the emergency doctor, Dr. Best, that night it affected him. And he was so patient. But, you know, he did say that. And, you know, same with my family doctor. It affects people.
And sexual assault affects, it trickles down.
Mm-hmm. And you know, everyone. It reaches in and, you know, people. And then, but you just, it builds you closer to these people too. My pharmacist, I have such a good relationship with my pharmacist, Joel at Family Pharmacy.
Shout out to Joel.
Mine's Aaron at the Shoppers on the far end. Love Aaron.
Like, it's just, you get these, you can't help but, you know, admire this little tribe of people that, you know, you have in your corner, your doctors and, you know, your therapists and your pharmacists. You know, if I have a problem, I'm going to, you know, my mom can roll into the pharmacy and grab my medication if I can't. It's, and knowing that, you know, I have those people and those big pillars beside me, it's huge.
Like you said, people are good.
People are good.
People that are good and just want to help.
Exactly.
And to surround ourselves with those people.
Yeah.
I love how you speak about healthcare professionals and mm-hmm. everybody that helped you, whether it's been, you know, losing a family member, going through different things. I've been in the hospital with Kristen. She's been in the hospital with me.
Yeah.
The people on the front lines of dealing with this mm-hmm. stuff are so unbelievably incredible.
Absolutely. And they deserve recognition.
Yes,
honestly,
they do.
Honestly. Yeah. And I will die on that hill.
Yeah, absolutely.
Me too.
Yeah. Perfect. We have another advocate to add to our We're Proud of all of the healthcare professionals. So what, obviously, we're passionate about the why of mm-hmm. things. And so what is your why? Why do you fight through the tough stuff?
Man, my why. I think my biggest why is just kind of other women. And, you know, the women who spoke out against Harvey Weinstein, you know, they're my why. I so admire them. But, you know, Nia Wilson, who was fatally stabbed a few months after I was, and her sister in the States, they're my why. You know, she passed away. He slit her throat, and her sister had to speak out and testify against him, and she's my why. You know, I wrote this thing of unexpected grief on my blog earlier, and I just wrote a line, you know, of the missing and murdered Indigenous women. They're my why. But then, you know, I look a little bit closer at my family and my little cousins. They're just sweet little girls, and they're my why, you know. I think that they deserve a fighting chance in this world to experience everything that they want to experience without getting sexually assaulted, like so many of us have. Mm-hmm. They're my why. And just, I'm my own why, I guess, too. I try and keep that.
I just got goosebumps.
I try and remind myself that. And yeah, the people who, I get a lot of emails from people kind of around the country who, you know, say thank you for speaking out. It's not safe where I am, or I don't have the resources, or places where, you know, laws are under attack against sexual assault victims. They're my why, and I think that's why I've decided to shine a big uncomfortable spotlight on myself, you know, because I do have the support and I do have the safety and the security to do so. And I think that I really take it on as a responsibility for all the women who didn't survive. Nia Wilson, you know, so many other mm-hmm. women who mm-hmm. have either been stabbed or shot by their domestic or intimate
anybody,
partners.
Yes, anybody.
You know, it's just, those are, I have other smaller ones, but
oh, that's
those
so
are my
I don't know if we've ever, that was a, you that's crushed a, the my why.
That's a big my why.
And so what is next for Marin? What are you going to be up to?
Honestly, I'm just, like I said before, I'm 22. I'm just kind of figuring it out, I guess. I just launched my new blog, actually. So I'm working on that, and I get a lot. I get about 50,000 monthly readers. So I enjoy, you know, reaching out and connecting with them. And that's been super cool. Other than that, I think just kind of finishing school and seeing where that goes. Maybe I'll take a different avenue when that's finished. I've got my Colts at home. I'm just kind of rolling with it, you know.
We are very excited to see what is next.
Thank you. I'm excited too. We'll see. I'm ready for it, I think.
Yeah. And
we're just like in
yeah,
awe.
We're in awe. We're just, yeah, in awe. So Maren's blog link will be in the show notes. And honestly, thank you so much, Maren, for coming.
Thank
and
you for having me.
Your truth.
I'm so honored.
Inspiration.
I'm so honored.
Kindred spirits.
Yeah.
I just love you, Maren.
Thank you so much to Maren Sutherland for coming and sharing her truth and identity defining moments. For you, the listener, we challenge you to consider a couple questions today. What are the moments in your life that changed everything? And have there been moments where there may have been a lesson? And what are your passions and what makes you truly happy? This has been another My Why podcast, and we are so grateful to everyone who has supported us so far. And to you, listening means so much. Reach out if you have a suggestion for a cast or if you want to help us continue these Wednesday stories of inspiration and resilience. Again, thank you so much to Maren and all of our presenters and guests so far. And yeah, we'll talk to you next Wednesday.